Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome Wauwatosa East High School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have students from Conserve High School. I'm sorry, it may not be high school, Conserve School. Would they stand, please? Good. We're delighted to have you with us, too. You may be seated. The students are here with a program that is a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students from across the state are invited to join us for an oral argument, and if they accept, we send them the briefs and the case that they are about to hear, and they may engage in other activities relating to this case. And then, after our second case, we have a justice of the court meet with the students, and everyone is invited to join at that meeting. It will be a discussion of the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues in the case. Is there anyone here who would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, if you don't already have information about the case? Okay, we will proceed now with my introducing the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. You will meet with Justice Wilcox today at about noontime. To Justice Wilcox's right is an empty chair, and ordinarily Justice Crook sits there. He will not be participating in this case. And on the far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. Starting at the other end of the court, on my far left, is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. With those introductions made, I'll now call the first case, 2005 AP 995, Marie L. Kasten versus Doral Dental USA, LLC. Arguing on behalf of Marie L. Kasten is Jane Schlicht.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Jane Schlicht. I represent the appellant in this case. Seated at council table with me is David McClurg, who is my co-counsel.
Sorry, Ms. Schlicht, I think you'll have to move in closer to the microphone, or maybe we can raise the...
Is that better, if I move it there? Okay. Now, this case raises issues concerning the rights possessed by members of a limited liability company under the limited liability company's operating agreement and under Chapter 183 of the Wisconsin statutes. Ms. Kasten became a minority non-managing member of Doral Dental USA, LLC in 2001. And Doral Dental, which is now known as DD Sale, processed Medicaid dental claims. After acquiring her interest in the LLC, Ms. Kasten became concerned about actions that were being undertaken by the management of the company and some of the controlling members' plans. Specifically, there were issues relating to some refinancing, as well as the possibility that some or all of the assets of the company might be being transferred to other entities. To determine what actions were being taken by the company's management and to find out what they were considering and planning and implementing, Ms. Kasten exercised her rights under the limited liability company's operating agreement, as well as under Section 183.0405 sub 2. And specifically, Ms. Kasten sought documents relating to the management's actions and relating to whether or not the LLC was transferring any of the assets or the business opportunities, and whether or not there were efforts to marginalize her interest in voting rights in the company. As detailed in the brief, the manager of the company rather vigorously resisted her efforts every step of the way. And as further detailed in the briefs, she was forced to enforce her rights by commencing an action to gain access to the documents. Once the action was filed, she was forced to file a motion asking the court to enter an order directing that the manager of the company provide the information. And ultimately, when the circuit court denied her request with regard to certain documents, she appealed the decision to the Court of Appeals.
Let me ask you, because I understand that she and her former husband are minority members, and then you had one majority member, and then you had some other people that had very minute interests. Is that correct? There were other people.
That is correct.
Under the statute, do all of the minority members, whether they're managing or non-managing, do they fall in the same category as any other member under the statute, because this is a statutory interpretation, and under the operating agreement? Are there different rights that there's a dentist that had a very small interest, I can't think of his name. Is he in the same box, so to speak, as far as getting information?
Obviously, there are differences in the operating agreement as to management of the company. Yeah. But with regard to procuring information regarding the documents themselves, there's absolutely no distinction whatsoever. It talks about members gaining access to the company documents and the company records. And likewise, the Wisconsin statute uses the same language. There's absolutely no distinction based on the ownership interest, and that's exactly how it should be, because I think what the legislature intended when they promulgated Chapter 183 is they wanted a certain transparency of rights and abilities of all members to seek out information about how the company is being operated and how the company is being managed. So as I was stating,
Dental turnover emails. It did, didn't it?
Initially, they provided some of the emails, but they did not provide all of the emails.
So what inference do we draw from that? Is the issue in this case really whether emails can be obtained, or is it something different from that?
Well, I think the issue in the case is whether or not emails are documents or records, because that certainly is the issue that the court reached, the circuit court, in saying that an email cannot be a document because it's like a telephone message, it's a communication. I think it's very clear that emails are documents, and I think the fact that the company originally turned over some of the emails was an acknowledgement on their part that that's part of their company documents. And it was apparent from the few that they did turn over that that's how they did business. They didn't write letters to one another. You know, they sent emails. And that's how they transacted businesses with their advisors as well.
Does everyone who owns any interest in this LLC, is that person an entity? Excuse me, is that person a member?
Yes.
So in this case, Marie Kasten had 23%+.
That's correct.
But someone who had less than 1% would have the same rights, in your view.
Exactly.
So that person who owned less than 1% could also demand 35,000 documents?
Well, I think it's somewhat of a misnomer to say there were 35,000 documents, but I think they, and I will explain that, I think that they can get access to the information under the operating agreement, and the operating agreement provides that they can get access to company documents. I think it's a misnomer to say that there were 35,000 documents produced, because what happened is originally the firm representing the company produced some banker's boxes worth of documents. And then when our firm became involved and went through those documents and saw what was missing from the original request, as well as the fact that a sale had taken place, a very significant sale had taken place, rather than produce the specific categories of documents we itemized, what they did is they reproduced the same old boxes of documents, and that's why the number is as large as it is.
But you're saying emails are records, in your view?
Absolutely.
Personnel files, are those records?
Sure they are. In fact, there's been some amendments made to the Wisconsin statutes that deal with the fact that a lot of information is being electronically created, electronically sent. And I can...
Trade secrets?
Well, trade secrets are documents, but those are something that is independently created by the, protected by the Uniform Trade Secret Act. And so, therefore, there are issues under the Uniform Trade Secret Act as to whether or not those sorts of documents would be produced and to whom they would be produced and with what sort of restrictions are made on them. But they're still documents.
Well, what about privileges then? So we have a document, but it's between the corporation and its lawyer. How does the corporation protect privileged documents, whether it be trade secret, client, attorney, or personnel? I mean, there are privacy interests of the individuals involved, right? The personnel records could have medical records that are maybe in the personnel files, but may have some confidentiality protection. So how you ask for everything, do they have to give you everything, or do they have to give you everything except where they claim some sort of privilege?
Well, I think that the way the statute is drafted and the way the operating agreement is drafted, they're obligated to give company documents. Certainly there are issues relating to attorney-client privilege, and in fact, initially, the company turned over documents that constituted communications between counsel and the company. Certainly as being a member, the member is entitled to find out what the lawyers are doing for the company, what they're charging the company, and what kind of activity is going on. That is not to say that there aren't other overriding protections. You mentioned the medical records. That's something that certainly the defendant has raised in arguing about protections, but the fact of the matter is that HIPAA has very specific regulatory requirements as to how protected patient information is to be maintained. And if you look at the regulations, and I believe I cited to one of them in our brief, if you look at the regulations relating to HIPAA, companies that have the potential for having protected patient information typically have separate servers on which that information is stored. It's not stored on the same servers by which that company conducts its business, demonstrates financial information, and certainly that isn't one of the categories of the information that Ms. Kasten asked for. If you look at the complaint that was originally filed in this action, it details the efforts that Ms. Kasten undertook in order to get the records that she believed were important for purposes of understanding what the management was doing. And it wasn't a request for, I want all of your company documents. There was a letter dated, I believe, February 21st of 2003, and in there it detailed that if there were any letters of intent as far as the sale or transfer of assets, they wanted that. They wanted financial information. They wanted tax returns. Those are all of the kinds of documents that are critical to understanding what the managers of a company are doing and what are the planned activities. And so the problem wasn't even presented because those weren't things she was even asking for.
One of the, and I had it called to my attention not long ago, that there are literally, well, there's thousands, 100,000 LLCs in the state of Wisconsin. What we do here today is not only about Durrell and Kasten, but it's going to affect all of these other entities. I'm just musing a bit, but what if we have, I think the idea of an LLC was to do something that was a little simpler than setting up a corporation, okay? If we adopt, let's say, you have the right to all of this, and then you have all of these other entities I mentioned, is this going to deter perhaps the operation or people getting into LLCs with some ease if we're going to have a, I hate to use the word, but it's if you're entitled to all the documents? And that's what I think Justice Prosser was asking, and he said, well, how minute does your interest have to be? So if there's a dispute within an LLC, I guess what I'm looking at or thinking about, and then you talk about transparency, well, just how everything has to be known, and when you want it, you're entitled to get it, is kind of, I think that's what you're telling us.
No, I think there's really two issues
okay,
what you're raising, and I'll address that. First of all, with regard to the breadth of the request, I believe that when the legislature promulgated the statute, it was their intent to have flexibility and transparency, and that was the general principle. But the statute specifically provides that the operating agreement can provide for far more limited access to the documents. So the way the LLC addresses that is that when the company is formed, if in fact the principals that are forming it want to have more constraints on the information that's available, then they spell it out in the operating agreement. And then the investors who become members know up front exactly what their rights are going to be. Are they going to have much access to information that the management is doing, or are they not? And then they can make an informed decision as to whether or not they in fact want to invest in the company.
Counselor, does it make any difference that the word data appears nowhere in the sections of 183 that you are describing to us?
Not at all. We have cited in our briefs, and I can refer to a few other sections, in which records are defined in such a way as to include electronic data. And so, for instance, if you look at section 137.11 sub 12, which was created to deal with electronic transactions, 409.102 sub 1 sub R, which was an amendment to the definition of record for purposes of secured transactions, and section 440.99 sub 8, which deals with athletic contracts, record is defined as information that is inscribed on a tangible medium or that is stored in electronic or other medium and is retrievable in perceivable form. That's how a record is defined. And likewise,
but these are not just any generic record, aren't they the LLC's records?
Yes.
Okay. So, and I appreciate your references to those sections. That is helpful. I guess my concern is if the legislature wanted the records spoken of in the statute, which are the LLC's records, why wouldn't they say including any LLC data?
Well, I think that records are defined throughout the statute in a way that doesn't necessarily use the word data. And keep in mind that at the very same time, or in the time frame, that the legislature was dealing with promulgating the LLC company statute, they also were working on amendments to the Uniform Commercial Code, because it was in the area of commercial transactions that really brought to the forefront e-business. And so, for example, under section 403, which deals with negotiable instruments, you know, one of the first amendments that were made by the legislature to deal with e-business, e-communication, was an amendment to the definition of what was a signature. And that made the amendment that allowed for the electronic signature. And it was an amendment made after the fact. In other words, there already were electronic transactions going on. And what this was is an effort by the legislature to bring that language in conformance with business realities, because banks and businesses were already translating or transferring funds electronically and doing other commercial transactions, and therefore there was a need to bring the statutory language in conformance with business realities, and business realities is electronic data.
Yeah, but so, Councillor, one thing that concerns me about the electronic parts of this is, you know, there's the email. What about the metadata that's underneath the email? Do you have a right to that, too?
Well, that's the issue of the drafts. Now, what the company has raised here is that getting drafts of documents is something so unusual or so burdensome, and in fact, that's not the case. Documents are electronically created, and they're electronically altered. And the metadata is what shows, is in essence, what's the draft of the document, because it shows the changes that were made. Now, keep in mind, another principle that comes into effect is not only the fact that the operating agreement can provide for what information a member can obtain, There's also the issue of document retention policies.
Counsel, before you move on to that, I want to follow up on the questions asked by both Justice Wilcox and Justice Rogensack. You have, in your argument, at least so far, seem to lump the statute 183.0405 with the operating agreement. And I'm not sure they provide for the same thing. I do see some limitations that are contained within the statute that may or may not be in the operating agreement itself, which may or may not provide for more. So I want to ask you how you view the two, whether the statute and the operating agreement call for disclosure of the same items. Does one call for more? Does one call for less?
Well, the statute sets the specific standard as to what does a company have to maintain, and that's listed in 183.0405 sub 1. And then sub 2 provides that a member can get access to that information, in other words, those listed items.
Sub 1E seems to have some limitations, and that's what I'm specifically what I'm referring to, that may or may not be included within the operating agreement. So I want to really focus in on sub 1E, because that doesn't seem to be a broad grant of access. It seems to be a grant of access subject to those limitations. Am I reading that incorrectly?
No, I don't think that's right at all, because I think sub 2 provides that a member is entitled to get all other limited liability records unless the operating agreement provides otherwise. And so I think that is what controls on the issue of the records they're entitled to get. So in summary, you have the list of items a company has to maintain and has to provide access to, and then the general rule is all other limited liability companies unless the operating agreement provides otherwise.
Well, how does the dictionary define records? I mean, there's no definition in 183 that I could find.
No, but
so the usual rule is you go to the dictionary.
Well, not necessarily the dictionary. I think you can go to other references in the statute where record is defined.
Well, but, you know, record is defined in a number of places for a number of different purposes. So they may or may not be the same as the purpose in 183. Also, 183.0405 two talks about record, company, limited liability company record required to be kept, and any other limited liability company record. Three talks about information, and you have been using record and information separately and then together. Are you using them differently?
Well, I think that records and documents have information. That's where information is contained.
So that you view whether the word is record, document, information, it's all the same.
Well, I don't know that information and document are the same. I mean, information is information. It's facts. It's financial information. The fact is where is it maintained? Where is it stored? Is it stored in a company's audited financial statement, or is it stored on an electronic disk? You get access to company documents so that you can obtain information concerning how the company is being managed and what actions the managers are taking.
What you're concerned about emails, and you're concerned about drafts, if I understand that.
Right.
Those are the two main concerns.
Those are the two issues that were raised on this appeal.
What's the interplay between 2 and 3? Under 2, a member may copy, on a reasonable request, may copy records. Under 3, members or the management, does this fall under members or management under 3? It says if the management is vested in one or more managers. Is this vested in one or more managers?
Oh, this company, in other words, a single manager.
Okay. So the manager shall provide, to the extent that the circumstances render it just and reasonable, true and full information of all things affecting the members, any member or legal representative. Are you coming in under 3?
No, we're coming in under 2.
Why?
because that's the provision that permits or requires an access of a member to the records of the limited liability company. I think that they dovetail in the sense that, in light of the fact that a manager has those obligations with regard to a member's, we don't think it's appropriate that we've gotten the level of resistance that we have in asking for the kinds of information we've asked for.
This case raises issues about the statute, in particular, a particular fact situation. And I gather it doesn't matter whether she was an original member of this corporation or she acquired it through a divorce proceeding or a purchase. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And as Justice Wilcox said, it affects, a ruling affects thousands of entities and people because you're interpreting a statute. Considering all that, what kind of opinion do you expect this court to write that would obviously hold for your client, because that's why you're here, but also take into account such language as a reasonable request under 2?
Well, the notion of reasonable request, I think as we've outlined in our reply brief, you know, goes to the notion as to, you know, what are the kinds of conditions that a member would impose to get the documents. For instance, you know, you can't demand that they turn them over within 48 hours. You have to give them a reasonable amount of time. You can't insist that they produce them in a format that isn't how they maintain them. So, for instance, maybe some of the information is maintained on backup tapes. It's not a requirement that they have to go hire somebody to convert it so that it meets your needs. The documents have to be produced, or the information has to be produced the way they maintain it. It has to be done at your expense, the member's expense. So,
Counselor, you say it has to be produced in the way they maintain it. What in the statute says that? I'm familiar with the new federal rule, which will require that in December in cases in federal court. We don't have such a rule, and I don't see anything like that in the statute.
No, I don't think there's anything in the rule. What I was responding to was the Chief Justice's question as to what I would like to see in the opinion relating to what would be a reasonable request.
Right, but you said that they have to produce it in the form that it's maintained, and I guess that was the part that was of concern to me, just that statement.
You were trying to show that they don't have to reformat everything. You were trying to be reasonable to the company.
Exactly. But maybe the use of the word they have to was the wrong thing. I guess my point was to say that
it
if
could.
It's a company document and it needs to be produced, it should be produced in the format it's maintained. The company doesn't have to incur an expense to be converting the way the data is maintained or the documents are maintained.
But if they chose to, you wouldn't have a problem with our saying that they could produce it in the form that it is stored, but they could produce it in some other way if they chose.
Well, as long as it's not a way that would make it more difficult, you know, to read the information or access the information.
Yeah, to me, you know, that's a very complicated question. And, you know, this court hasn't considered what the federal court has done on electronic discovery, but I think it's tremendously complicated. And, okay, well, thank you. I think I understand. Thank
you. Are you familiar with the case we had a couple of years ago relating to a request for documents, including electronic documents or records from the legislature?
I don't believe so.
Well, the court, the result of the request was that the court viewed it as asking for too much because there were backup tapes, and the backup tapes covered more than what might be relevant in that particular lawsuit. And so the court struck it down. Do you have that problem here?
Well, I was going to talk about that, and I started to talk about document retention policies. The statute obviously talks about operating agreements and how operating agreements can put limitations on the sorts of company documents that a company is obligated to produce. But most companies have, or certainly they should have, a document retention policy. And many companies don't keep all the backup tapes. They rotate them more as crisis management, and they only keep a small snapshot of that information and rotate it out. So with companies that have document retention policies, there isn't that issue because they already are, as part of their regularly conducted business activities, only maintaining the information that they need for their operations.
Well, counsel, before the federal rule, and this has been developing in the last 10 years, the approach taken, both in state and federal courts generally, has been that it is up to the trial court to get the parties together if they can't get together themselves and if there's a dispute, and shake out exactly what documents are wanted, exactly how the company keeps those documents, exactly what the retention, exactly what the metadata is, et cetera, et cetera. And then the trial court with the parties appropriately, if it's appropriate, narrows the request. It's hard for you to say what you want when you don't know what the records keeping is. So they narrow the request to make it sound. How can we do that here?
Well, I don't know that the court can come up with a specific across-the-board way of narrowing it in this instance, because every company is going to be a little different as to what data they create and what they maintain.
So what should the court do?
Pardon me?
What should the court
do? What I think the court should do is acknowledge the fact that, as a general principle, the Wisconsin legislature has enacted 183.0405 sub 2 to give transparency to the members so that they can get access to information. But, however, that can be limited by virtue of the operating agreement. And in this case, there is no limitation in the operating agreement. Clearly, emails and drafts are part of documents, and accordingly, the circuit court erred when it concluded that Durell Dental had no obligation to produce the emails and the drafts.
Does it have to be sent back to the trial court to work out an agreement between the parties with that, if that was accepted by the court? And that any privileges be set forth then?
I think certainly it has to be sent back to the trial court so that the company is instructed to search for where these information must be, where it is maintained, or where they have it in their possession or control. And I think the circuit court is ultimately going to have to address the issue of the attorney-client privilege, which is something we raised in the lawsuit. But before the case was dismissed, there was an ample opportunity to develop the record as to what was the level of privileged communications, whether or not there were any exceptions to the privilege that applied. But certainly on remand, the circuit court is going to have to address that issue.
And that's what, in effect, you're requesting, is a remand with a policy statement of openness and transparency.
That's correct.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Kay Scott Wagner, representing Durell Dental USA, LLC.
Good morning. May it please the court. I apologize in advance. I have a wicked cold. I had it for 2 weeks and lost it, but I found it again, which never happens to me in Vegas, but when it comes to germs, apparently I'm lucky that way. I have an outline. I'm going to go off it. Maybe it's just the DayQuil talking. But what I want to do is start with the interpretation of the statute, and I think pick up on something that Justice Abrahamson was speaking about. The way it makes sense to me to interpret sections 1, 2, 3 of section 183.0405 is to recognize that they all say different things. Section 1 specifically defines records under the LLC statute. Now, it may not be exhaustive. I grant you that.
Records required to be kept at the home office or whatever the language is.
Yes, Your Honor.
Some of them, right?
We certainly know those are LLC records. Okay. It may not be exhaustive. I wouldn't disagree with you on that. But I think it is illustrative of the type of documents that are actually records. And when you look at subsection 2, you know, there's two terms, and I'm sort of flashing ahead. I'm going to cover it in more detail later, depending on where we go. But when you look at subsection 2, there's really two undefined terms. One is upon reasonable request, and two is, I guess the reason we're here, limited liability company record. And the court is correct You certainly could go to a dictionary to look up record, but what Doral did was we went to other similar statutes to see what the legislature had used to define records in a limited partnership statute and in the corporation statute. And those are significantly narrower. They're very formal documents, you know, relating to specific proceedings, operating agreements, amendments to corporate structure, and I'll go through them in more detail later. But it is not, and I want to stress what the request we're dealing with here is, any and all emails from 2001 to the present.
Counsel, if I could, there was a word that you left out when you described sub 2, and I think it's a word that is going to be important to this case, and it's the word other. And so I think in describing record, I want to make sure that we're talking about not just that which is limited to sub 1, because otherwise the word other wouldn't be included.
And let me be perfectly clear, Your Honor. I hope that wasn't the substance of what you took from me. I am suggesting sub 1 is illustrative. It does say other limited liability company record, so I'm not suggesting it's exhaustive. But what I am suggesting is that it is illustrative of the type of formal document that would be a limited liability company record.
You're relying on the doctrine of justum generis?
Is how it's been used in the other similar statutes, yes. And then
the similar statutes or in this particular
statute? In this particular statute, I'm sorry. Is a matter of illustrating what was intended. And then the other thing the court talked about was information. And I think information is broader than records. And information is really the key to the transparency that Ms. Kasten is concerned about. But the reason they didn't go under sub 3, I would suggest to the court, is not because they didn't think they were seeking information. It's because they know that the requests that are before this court would never meet the scrutiny of upon circumstances which render it just and reasonable, true and full information of all information affecting the partnership will be given to members. And that's because whatever the concerns, and we may talk about those later, the specific email request that we are here on is not related to any concerns. It doesn't distinguish personal emails. In the trial court, Ms. Kasten argued if there were personal emails on the computer, she got them, because if they were to, from, or by any of the three employees of the company. Now, I don't think any reasonable interpretation of limited liability company record would include personal emails.
Well, why are there personal emails on company time and company machinery?
Well, there's two different issues, Your Honor. On the one, the fact is there probably are. There are on my emails. Sometimes my wife will, you know, say, pick up Sydney at 4:30. They could be there. And that's
not... Object to turning that over?
I would. I don't think it's within the scope of a limited liability company record.
Mm-hmm. Well, who owns the record, then? I know, you know, I'm used to this bailiwick, and this bailiwick being the Supreme Court and working in state government in this building. And I would think that, I don't know, but I would advance that maybe someone has to own a record. I mean, it has to be someone's record, right? I mean, you don't have a record without a home. There are no homeless records in this world. Everyone has, someone owns it. So who owns that record? Let's say it's on your office computer, paid for by your office, maintenance by your office, software purchased by your office. Do you own that record, or does company own that record? Who owns it?
I'm clearly on a plank here, Your Honor, because we haven't researched this, but I think it would be dependent upon the facts and circumstances of what the company policy is. I imagine different companies set up different procedures for what the process for personal email is. To be perfectly frank, I don't know what Doral's policy was for personal emails on here.
My follow-up question to Justice Bradley was going to be, do you think the sender and the receiver could have, on the date of sending and receiving, delete the email and then write over it so it really would be out of the system, but you wouldn't know whether they could do that then?
I would just be speculating. I don't know what the policy for Doral was.
Thank you.
You're not taking the position, though, that all emails are excludable, are you?
Your Honor, I'm not, and I don't think the trial court did either. I think what the trial court was saying is looking at the specific request, which is all emails over a three-year period to, by, or from three people, you know, those are not records. There could be a situation where a formal type of document, such as a record, which is, we believe it's designed, defined illustratively in sub 1, or in the limited partnership statute, or in the corporate statute, could be an electronic format. And at that point, I don't think you could say, well, it's not a record because it's not an email. But we also get past that when you get to sub 3, which talks about information and is not limited to records. The only condition, and again, suggesting that information is broader, the only issue about getting information, which may include considerably less formal documents than records, is have you shown a purpose and isn't just and reasonable to turn the documents over? Is it affecting the members' interest in the LLC? And I would suggest that standard is very similar to the standard we have set up under the corporate statutes, which talk about a relatively limited amount of records you can get under Chapter 180, and then you have to show a proper purpose. You have to show that the records that you are requesting are reasonably related to that proper purpose, and then you go forward.
Yeah, but, counsel, it's pretty hard to show that the record is reasonably related unless you know what's in the record. Here you have conversations on the email, allegedly, among people who are involved in selling this entity. And therefore, one thinks that there's going to be stuff in these emails that would be helpful to the plaintiff in proving it, her charges.
But, Your Honor, then I would suggest the appropriate request would have been, under sub 3, showing they have a concern about the sale, and then saying, give me all the emails related to the sale.
And if it said, give me all the emails directly or indirectly related to the sale, including any items that were to not be sold but transferred to another entity, you'd comply with that.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the last part of it?
Well, I'm trying before to get to where that they might have sold X, Y, and Z of this entity but not A, B, and C because they were doing A, B, C elsewhere. I mean, I gather that's one of the issues of whether they're keeping for themselves some stuff, like the computer stuff. And so if there was a request like that, you would hand it over. You think that would be okay?
It would depend on what showing was made. It can't be idle curiosity, and I would suggest it's a progressive step. If you would say, for example, I'm concerned about the transaction. Give me some documents so I can understand the transaction. I don't think that would mean, out of the box, you would get every single piece of data that could conceivably be related to the transaction. Instead, you might get the letter of intent, you might get correspondence, you might get other things that explain what the transaction is. At that point, if you come back and say, look, I have specific concerns based on what I've already examined, and these are my questions, give me information responding to that. I think that would be the reasonableness balancing test, which we're talking about in sub 3.
Well,
and, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And I think that's very similar to what happens in the corporate case, which is it, do you have a proper purpose? Is it reasonably related to your proper purpose?
Well, I think in looking at this, and I'm going to follow up on the Chief Justice's questions, it seems to me that there is an allegation here that certain assets were being transferred outside of this sale. I mean, this is an allegation, if I read this, to diminish the value of whatever opposing counsel's client had. I mean, her one asset was worth so much money. So let's take it down to just real. If you were transferring certain assets and they asked about that, that would be within the, I would say, the normal business request, wouldn't it? Because if that would affect the value of what I own. If you want to put it into a corporate context, and I own 100 shares of whatever, a small, you can't, not GE, but certainly, let's say, a Wisconsin corporation set up, and there are 10 members, and if they're transferring equipment to certain members, that's information that you'd want to know about.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would suggest at that point you wouldn't say, give me all your emails for 4 years.
You'd say the specific.
You would say, I'm concerned about transfer of certain assets. Give me the documents about it. And then we go into the balancing test of how much you get and when you get it and at what point.
So what you're saying, and to use a metaphor, this you want, rather than a shotgun approach, you're saying they've got a rifle in, they've got to pinpoint what they want and not to have this massive exchange of information.
Well, I don't know how much they have to pinpoint, but they have to come within a few miles, I would say. I mean, we have to have some general subject area about what we're talking about before we just turn it over.
And, counsel, I'm curious about what exactly was turned over. And I understand that some emails, according to opposing counsel, were turned over earlier. And I guess my question goes to whether or not any of the emails involving these three individuals dealing with dissolution of the LLC, whether the emails from those three individuals were, in fact, turned over.
Regarding the sale of the LLC?
Regarding the sale, or it talks about dissolution events. So I guess I'm looking more in terms of any events that may lead to the dissolution of the LLC. Was that already turned over or not?
Your Honor, I cannot say, some of them were. I cannot say conclusively that all of them were. As near as I can tell, I wasn't the trial counsel. What happened was, I have 39 boxes of documents, and it is 35,000 documents, plus the 4,000 that were subpoenaed from others. In the appropriate files, there are email correspondence. In the beginning, and this was going to go into the theme I was going to weave into, but I've long since lost it, was it's giving the emails was not an implication of anything other than no good deed goes unpunished. I mean, we understood that this was the ex-wife of Craig Kasten. We understood they had been through a very contentious divorce, and we understood that perhaps in an effort to save money that we would just give anything to her so she could satisfy herself and hopefully we would avoid litigation. Now, the irony of that is not lost on me, but hindsight is 20/20 because now we've been through two pieces of litigation because of that. But I don't want the court to take some kind of waiver by the fact that we basically said, look at whatever you want. We've got nothing to hide. Go in. And some emails came out. What happens later is, actually the complaint is kind of interesting. It's not your usual document complaint if you look at it. When Attorney Kravitz drafted the complaint, he doesn't list the specific documents that haven't been produced. He lists all the correspondence he has had. And then he says, some have been produced and some haven't. So even from the beginning, this was not your usual documents case, which is usually, I asked for 5, 6, and 7. They only gave me 6. We're here on 5 and 7. How do we work from it? But then it gets worse, because when the new counsel comes in June, there's 20 brand new requests. Okay? And it is 35,000 documents that were produced, because what happened was, when the original documents were produced, they weren't bait stamped. So they were reassembled and then produced with additional documents. So there's no duplication in there.
Counsel, I understand that your argument is that the request was too broad, and I accept that in terms of your argument. My question goes more or less to the response that in responding, did your client take the position, well, fine and Danny, we're not going to turn anything over and just you have to pinpoint it? Or did your client actually go through, try to comply with sub E3 and provide Mrs. Kasten with the information that dealt towards dissolution events? That's what I'm trying to narrow. I'm just trying to figure out how broad this challenge is here and what has been turned over and what hasn't been turned over.
And I'm sorry, Your Honor, I was getting the long way there. What happened was when they threw in the towel was when the motion to compel came on all emails over a 3-year period. And that's when the wall stopped. That's when they said, you know, we're not getting anywhere here. Emails were produced. I wasn't there. I have reviewed the files. I cannot say with certainty or I can't represent to you that all emails were provided. What it appears was that the emails, were whatever file they were in, is how they were filed, were given. What they did not do and what they refused to do was go back and simply search the server for any email, regardless of files, for a 3-year period authored by the three employees. And to me, that's my understanding of where we're at today.
Counsel, I took from your brief a general argument that the three parts to litigation, the divorce, the fight over getting records, and then some substantive complaints. I'm having a little trouble trying to figure out just what are the stakes in this case here. Why is there still such a big fight about this case here?
Your Honor, it's a question I ask virtually every day. One of the reasons we had moved to supplement the record to talk about, you know, whether this case is moot or not, because one of the arguments that Ms. Kasten makes is, geez, I should have rights just as broad as discovery in this case to pursue these allegations. And our point is, you did. We had a substantive case. She sued Reinhart, which is who she wants to pursue this attorney-client fraud exception. She sued all the individuals. She sued the members of the LLC and proceeded on the substantive allegations that are were the basis of her request to adjourn the summary judgment motion. The court, as you can see in our motion to supplement the record, specifically said, while I viewed the operating agreement and the corporate statute as narrower, you get the full rights of discovery here. And it's not in the record, but let me tell you, they exercised it, although not about these specific documents. So to me, I believe this particular case is about as moot as it can be, because whatever allegation she was going to pursue, she had full discovery rights for. And Ms. Kasten's response was, well, I didn't choose to pursue these specific documents. But to me, that's not an answer to mootness. The fact you had the right to do it in the substantive case, the fact you had the right to pursue full discovery and chose not to do it, doesn't make this case any less moot. And frankly, it's a question the trial court in that action was asking as well.
As I understand the position of your opposing counsel, they would like the court to define a little bit what the statute means and what the operating agreement means and remand. What would happen on the remand?
Your Honor, I'm not sure it would happen on remand. I don't think there's any need for a remand. I think regardless of how this court chooses to define record, it can find, as the trial court did, that the requests we're talking about now are too broad. And there's no basis for a remand. How is the court going to deal with, I guess I'm having trouble envisioning a scenario where the court would say, all right, let me think about any and all emails over a 3-year period. You know, under what circumstances would the statute require that kind of blanket disclosure unrelated to a specific topic? And I think...
Counsel, I want to look at the statute because, you know, I don't know who wears the good hats and the bad hats in this case, and I really don't care. I'm concerned about what the statute says and what the operating agreement says and what and trying to follow and give meat to the words of the statute. I want to focus on sub 2 in 183.04.05. And we've done a lot of discussion, I think, about the first three words, upon reasonable request. What's request? What's reasonable? I shouldn't say this. I've become cynical enough in my life based on my experiences both as an attorney defending and responding to interrogatories and as a trial court judge to know that the number 35,000 sounds big. But you sit there when you're defending a larger case and you say, okay, we can respond to these interrogatories and give them what they want. We cannot give them what they want, or we can flood them with everything. And I have seen all of that happen. I don't know what was done here, but, you know, the numbers, I come out at an even, you know. They don't tell me a lot. I want to talk about the statute. Upon reasonable request, is what we've been discussing. This next word, a member may. Now, as you interpret the statute, does the statutory language qualify as to what type of member? Your opposing counsel started her oral argument pointing out that this is a minority non-managing member. Does the statute limit the type of member that sub 2 applies to?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. I guess it would be unusual for a managing member to make a request of himself, but with that exception, I think any member is entitled to do it under the statute.
Anything unclear about at the member's own expense, at least in terms of this case?
I think the issue would be, and it wasn't one that was raised in the trial court, does own expense mean the cost of copying, or does own expense mean the cost of having lawyers go through all the documents and, you know, in reasonably reviewing for privilege or anything else.
And in some ways that might tie into upon reasonable West, I suppose.
I think it does, Your Honor, and I also think that dovetails with the spirit of three.
Inspect and copy during ordinary business hours. You got any problem with what those words mean in this case?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Any limited liability record required to be kept under sub 1. Do you have any problem with what those words mean?
I think we're in agreement on that so far.
Okay. And unless otherwise provided in the operating agreement. I take that to mean that this statute controls unless otherwise provided for in the operating agreement to the contrary or differing from this statute.
I think only as to the last clause, Your Honor. I don't think you can opt not to provide the records described in sub 1.
Okay, thank you. I think, and I agree with you on that. Any other limited liability company record? Any, you know, that's pretty darn broad. I think often in the past we've had the, you know, depends on what is. Well, does this depend on what any is? I mean, any is pretty broad, it seems to me.
I think it depends on the four words taken in connection with what limited liability company record means.
Okay. Now, as I understand it, you said you didn't know who owned emails with this company. Is that correct?
I did. That's what I said, Your Honor.
Okay. So you don't really know whether or not an email would be construed as a limited liability company record as a matter of fact. Now, there might be different as a matter of law, but as a matter of fact, you don't know who asserts ownership in this context for an email.
Well, I have a problem with the fundamental assumption of your question that an email is a record.
Okay.
And that's where I would fight you.
Okay. Very good.
As to who owns the email, I don't know.
Okay. Then how do we define record? You've said we go to other statutes.
Yes, Your Honor.
You go to, if you're talking about plain meaning, you just go to a dictionary definition.
Yes, Your Honor. The reason we picked the statutes that we did is not only because they were good for us, but because I think what this Court said in Godsacker was that the LLC statute borrowed heavily from corporations and partnerships. So it wasn't like I pulled them out of the air. And the limited partnership is particularly similar to this entity because it is a member-managed LLC. And so the other members have a relationship that is very much like a limited partner in a limited partnership. You know, they don't control the company.
I look at the definition of record under public records, Chapter 19. And at least, and I grabbed the Department of Justice brochure on interpreting records and public records. And they define email as a record in their brochures, you know, that they give to public officials. Is any moment to be given to that statutory definition?
Your Honor, my short answer is no, and let me tell you why. I think the other two statutes are closer in purpose, and I also think if you look at sub 3 here, and if you were to interpret record that broadly to include anything, the term information in sub 3 would be virtually meaningless, and the two statutes would apply to the same thing. If you have record being limited and information being broader, and then you have the give and take of balancing of whether to turn over information.
I'll tell you what bothers me, and that is, you know, sometimes, and I'll refer to myself, you know, in this court, not everything for my operation, not everything's up to date in Kansas City. You know, I like to read the written cases, and so I get them off the Internet, but I print them because I read better when something is printed in them. But it's my belief in the world of business and in a lot of law offices. Boy, the world of business and in a lot of law offices, it is virtually all email these days. And that's how they do business. Now, I might not do business that way, but that's how they do business. So it seems it's problematic to me that an email, that there is no email, you're saying, that is a record. Because I think that's how they do business.
Well, again, we have to take, if you took record in the broad sense, obviously that would reach a different result. But in the context of the other corporate statutes or the partnership statute, I think that's true. But I think the issue you're raising is solved by sub 3, which allows allows members access to information, regardless of whether or not it's a record, which could include emails to the extent it affects the membership interest. So it's not like we're foreclosing a line of inquiry. What we're doing is, if you look at sub 3, you have to make a showing of reasonableness and upon circumstances which make it just and reasonable, which is, again, consistent with both the corporate and the partnership statutes. It's not that you can't get it, but you can't shotgun for any email under the sun over a 3-year period.
Well, did the trial court have a hearing where the parties came in and said, tell me why this is reasonable or why it's not reasonable? Or is this court order that no emails, just no emails? No. I know that you have the transcript in the appendix.
The transcript is in the appendix, Your Honor. There was discussion over whether or not emails would be records under the statute.
Is your position they are not records?
Your Honor, my position is the emails requested are certainly not records. I am not foreclosing the possibility that if someone puts an electronic format a formal document such as required or similar to the record statute, that it couldn't be a record.
Okay, but then you're telling me if the final agreement of sales was in an email, you'd accept that as a record. But communications between three people at the entity about the sale, about terms, you're saying that's not...
It's not a record as defined.
It's not a record. I'm just trying to find out. The drafts of the documents, you think they're not records either?
I don't think they're records, Your Honor, and I also think they were turned over. Because if you look at, and this is something that was mentioned in...
Well, the judge said you didn't have to produce them. I'm reading from Judge Wolfbram's order.
He did say that, Your Honor, and I believe there's two things. One, I think he's correct in that they're an informal document, which would not be the same as a record. They might be information upon a proper showing of reasonableness, but I don't think they're records. But if you look at Ms. Reichelt's affidavit, which referenced Mr. Kravitz's affidavit, which is record 29, Mr. Kravitz, in paragraphs 8 and 10, talks about how he was negotiating back and forth, and he said he needed documents related to any contemplated sale. That's in paragraph 8. And then he says, in fact, it was my duty to review as many documents as possible to advise her on her claims and on how much money she was entitled to receive. In my judgment, my efforts on Ms. Kasten's behalf resulted in rearrangement of the sale of Doral to DentaQuest Ventures for her significant benefit. Her counsel not only saw drafts, he helped negotiate the sale to her benefit. That's what he swore. And so we're not talking about not seeing any agreements at all. And there's a new one I found yesterday, and I'm sorry. It's record 68, and it was attached to the motion to delay the summary judgment motion. It's an exhibit filed by Mr. McClure. And it was a confidential settlement memorandum from Mr. Kravitz to Mr. Borka. Now, why he's filed it, I don't know, but he did. And in there, Mr. Kravitz writes, "We have carefully read and analyzed the offer of sale activities of DD over the past 2 years, including the ACS nearly successful letter of intent and the DentaQuest actual deal as expressed in the signed letter of intent and back and forth correspondence related to it." That's what Mr. Kravitz is saying he looked at, in addition to telling you he helped negotiate the deal to benefit Ms. Kasten. So I don't think drafts are formal documents, but I don't want the court to be left with the impression that, you know, we suddenly were foreclosing any kind of information to this claimant, because it's not true.
What kind of opinion do you expect from this court? I know you want to win, and you don't want to give up anything that you didn't have to give up. But what kind of opinion makes sense for not only you, but for other LLCs?
Your Honor, I think the opinion would look at the statute, harmonize it. I think we have to figure out what a limited liability company record is. I think we should describe what information versus a record is. And I would hope that regardless of how record or information is concluded, that it would not pass any reasonable test, whether it's upon reasonable request or upon circumstances that are reasonable, and that the trial court would be affirmed.
Counselor, I have one last question. I see your red light is on, so I'll be brief. Is it a subject of dispute that the software that Craig Kasten developed had the potential to process not only Medicare dental claims, but also commercial dental claims at the time that the interest in DD was, or Doral Dental, sorry, I'm using my own, was sold to DentaQuest?
I don't think there's any issue on that, Your Honor.
Well, could it? That's my question.
My understanding is it could, Your Honor. I'm not conceding ownership of the software, which is in a different company. I don't want to, but in terms of what the software could do?
Yes.
And again, maybe I'm speaking out of turn and shouldn't say with such certainty. I don't know that there was a substantive difference between the two, but maybe the best answer is I just don't know.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Your Honor, my red light's on. I didn't get the opportunity.
Justice Prosser has a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Wagner, there's been reference to the number of LLCs in Wisconsin. It's my understanding it's in the neighborhood of 150,000. But that's domestic filings. There are foreign filings, and there have to be quite a number of thousand of those, although not nearly the same number. Is the interpretation that we give to the statute going to apply to these foreign filings as well?
Your Honor, I believe it will under sub 8 of 1E30102. But I'm just looking at that now, so give me 1 second.
The statute you're citing is which one?
I'm looking at the definition, Your Honor. I'm looking at 183.0102. And sub 8 defines what a foreign limited liability company is. And I don't know the answer. I'm trying to find it quick. I don't know the answer off the top of my head, Your Honor. Your Honor, it doesn't use the term foreign limited liability company in 183.0405, so I don't know that it would, because it does make a distinction between limited liability companies and foreign limited liability companies. Those seem to be defined terms.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Schlicht? Ms. Schlicht, are you still asking for records wherever they are, even if they're in the possession of a successor company?
Well, I don't know that the company has to go get them from the successor company, but the fact that the successor company has them under the statute, Ms. Kasten is entitled to obtain them. And, in fact, we went through a great deal of trouble and expense in order to get the emails from DentaQuest, which is the company that bought a significant amount of the assets of Doral. And we hired a computer forensic expert who went in and made copies of the servers. And this goes to the whole idea of the burden. I mean, it truly is not as difficult as either the defendant or a lot of people would like to portray it. There are computer forensic companies that exist not only because of all the e-discovery and everything else, but they perform other things. And we hired a computer forensic expert, and he was there for a few hours talking with the DentaQuest IT person, and he made copies of the emails. But then the problem was is that Doral then interfered in it by filing a motion for a protective order saying, If you can't get emails from us because the courts are not company docs, you can't get them from a third party. And the court didn't agree with that. And then when that didn't work, then the Doral wanted to be able to screen the emails to decide which emails they're going to provide, whether or not they're going to give them. And so ultimately we didn't get the information because then the case got dismissed. But my point is she has the right to get them where they are. She was doing it at her own expense, as the operating agreement provides. And she should be able to get that information. I'd like to...
This moot?
No. I guess I would point out, Your Honor, that originally the defendant sought to make that argument about mootness, and the court entered an order striking that, and they had to remove that from their briefs. And so technically, My understanding is that was not before the court. But we did, with relative to their motion, address that issue. What they're arguing is that once information was found that provided the basis for a lawsuit, they amended the operating agreement retroactively to severely limit the amount of information members like Ms. Kasten can get. And that certainly doesn't render it moot. That's on appeal to the Court of Appeals. We believe that it cannot be retroactively imposed. She made a request beginning in 2003. An amendment that's done in the summer of 2005 certainly cannot be the basis for limiting her rights. Likewise, with regard to the claims she raised in the substantive complaint, the court never addressed the substance of those allegations. What the argument was is whether or not she could bring claims on behalf of the company, whether or not under the statute she had the ability to do that. And the court agreed with opposing counsel or the defendants on that case and dismissed it, and that's on appeal as well. So I don't believe it's moot at all.
Well, should we be handling this case piecemeal? A little bit here, a little bit there?
Well, we certainly would welcome the court to take up the issues that are presently before the Court of Appeals, because some of them...
You have that in mind. I had that in
mind. But I certainly think that the issues that are raised here can be dealt with independently of the issues that are raised in the other lawsuit, because the issues here are what rights does a member have.
Counselor, are you trying to get compensation for this other application, which you think may be lucrative, as was the application of the software to process Medicare claims? Is that what you're talking about here?
To get compensation? Well, what happened is that the software was transferred to another company. And
right, but obviously DentaQuest got some particular rights to use it because they're doing the Medicare business.
Right. Okay. They got a license.
All right.
But what is going on is that the principals of Durell Dental, prior to the sale, set up other companies for these other ventures that they wanted to do. And rather than allowing those business opportunities to be explored by Durell Dental, they spun off a bunch of other companies in which Ms. Kasten and the other members had no interest. And they're using that software, which is obviously very valuable, to generate other revenue, which the other members aren't enjoying.
Right. So what you really have a claim for is that you weren't fairly compensated for this transfer to these other companies, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So you're asking for a money damages if you could get the information you want. You think you're owed more than you've been paid so far.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Counsel, I'm concerned about the breadth of the request, and I saw your red light just went on, so I'll make this a little bit quick in terms of my question. But for me, I see a substantive difference in asking someone for an email that deals with, all right, what can we do to take so-and-so out of the company versus, hey, you want to get together for lunch? What time do you want to get? Where do you want to go? Do you want to go out to dinner? Where do you want to go? And I'm a little bit concerned about the breadth of the request, because it would seem, at least from the way you define records, that that would apply to both types of requests.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one of the issues I wanted to raise. What the defendant in this case is doing is saying that we asked for all emails, and in fact that is not the case. If you look at the respondent's appendix, one letter that I wrote, dated June 7th of 2004, identifies what we were looking for, and we were looking for emails between specific individuals, and we were looking for internal communications in the email form between the officers. So we weren't looking at every possible email. We wanted to find out about how they were running the business. And we couldn't be more specific than that, because they conduct their business by email, and to limit it is, in essence, letting the fox guard the hen house, because then they're going to decide what they're going to produce. The other issue, too, is goes to the cost. If, in fact, what's going to be decided is that there's going to be this ongoing procedure that first you say, well, what you want, and then we'll give you that, and then you justify why you want a little bit more, and then maybe we might give that. That's going to be very cost prohibitive, and that's what's going to make it expensive, and that's what created the expense in this case. Had they simply sat down with us and let our expert go in there, reach an agreement on how to produce it, there wouldn't be this expense. But if you're going to continually having these stages of interplay, you're going to have lawyers involved, you're going to have the management involved, and that's when it's going to cause a disruption, and that's when it's going to cause excessive expense.
Thank you.
Did you want emails involving any of these three individuals that involved luncheon engagements?
Involved in, I'm sorry?
Luncheon engagements.
Well, we certainly don't need those emails, but it's cost prohibitive to filter those out. They're certainly obviously not damaging. They're part of the company records because they were made on the company documents. And that's the way you cost-effectively get them, is you have somebody go in and copy the servers and download those to a DVD. And then they can be searched at Ms. Kasten's expense to determine what she needs to prove her claims. I guess I would just like to note a couple other things.
Time is almost up, but so make it very, very rapid.
On the issue of whether or not there was any discussion at the trial court level about documents in email format, I was trial counsel, and I did bring that up. And the court never entertained the fact that documents sent electronically could be something that was produced. As long as it was an email, it could not be produced. And I tried to convince the court of that distinction, and unfortunately was not successful. And I think, as some of the justices here have mentioned, email is the way people are doing business. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Thank you, Mr. Wagner, for your arguments on this limited liability company case. That concludes 2005 AP 995, Kasten versus Doral Dental USA, LLC. The court will take a few moments of recess, but just a few, for other students to enter the courtroom if they are here. And is our counsel for the next case, Nicole W., in the chambers? Counsel here? All right. You are excused.